Well, one day a teacher in a classroom in school said to the children, "Who knocked down the walls of Jericho?" There was a long silence, and the little boy said, "Please, sir, I didn't." So the teacher later in the staff room said to the headmaster, "Do you know what happened in my classroom today? I asked, who knocked down the walls of Jericho? And that boy Smith said, please, sir, I didn't." The headmistress said, "Well, I've known Smith some years, and I know his family. It's a good family." He said, "If he says he didn't, I'm sure he didn't." So the teacher explained to the headmaster. Later that day, the school inspector came. The headmaster decided to tell him this and said, "You know what happened in one of our classes today?" He said, "The teacher said, who knocked down the walls of Jericho?" And the boy called Smith said, "Please, sir, I didn't." The inspector said, "Well, it's awfully difficult in these cases to find out who did." He said, "Get it repaired and send the bill in." And of course, the point of that joke is that everybody should know. The joke falls flat if people don't know who knocked down the walls of Jericho. And I suppose that story is the best known part of the book of Joshua, which is our book to study right now. Everybody knows about the walls of Jericho, especially because of the song, the Negro spiritual. Joshua fought the battle of Jericho and the walls came tumbling down. That's widely known. And that's about the limit of people's knowledge of this book. And in a scientific age, people even have doubts about that. How were the walls knocked down? And who knocked them down? They then ask questions about the whole book. What kind of a book is this? How does it fit into the Old Testament? What value is this book to Christians? Now, it's the sixth book in the Old Testament, and in English, it just seems to carry on from the fifth. We have the five books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and the story finishes at the end of Deuteronomy with Moses' death. And then Joshua just seems to pick the story up at exactly the same point. And Joshua, Moses' successor, carries on the leadership of God's people. So what's different? And why is this book not read annually in the synagogue, whereas Deuteronomy is? You see, in our Bibles, it looks no different, does it? It just carries straight on, and the story continues. But to the Jew, there is a profound difference between Deuteronomy and Joshua. Deuteronomy is part of the law of Moses. Joshua isn't. Quite a different book. And of course, if you really think about it, Deuteronomy is packed with what I've called legislation. It's packed with the laws of God. There isn't a single law anywhere in the book of Joshua or in any of the books that follow it. We are out of the law country. Or in a word, we are out of the foundation of the nation. We are now into the outworking of that constitution. So the first five books of our Bible are the basic constitution of the people Israel. That's their foundation. And the rest of the Old Testament is how it all works out. So that when you put the book of Joshua, which is the first non-law book in the Bible, against the first five books, you see a remarkable change. I've tried just to indicate this. See, the next six books are all what we call history. In the next video that I'm going to make with you, I'll show you that the Jews don't call these books history at all. They actually call them prophecy. But I'm afraid we tend to think of them as history. And the story continued. But when you read those five books and then these six books, then you realize the contrast between them. This is the law, the foundation of Judaism. And they usually call the first five books the Torah, which means instruction. And basically every Jewish rabbi is instructed in those five books and they're read through once a year. But here we have in the Jewish scriptures, these are called the former prophets. We don't ever think of them like that. And in the next video, we're going to look at why. Here we have God's promises to them. But here we have the fulfillment of those promises, how God kept his word. Here God says what he will do, but here he does it. And once again, this grace-gratitude theme comes out. The grace of God is very clear in the first five books. In the next six, we shall see quite a bit of gratitude, not quite enough, but quite a lot. Here the redemption, here the righteousness, here the legislation in the law of Moses, but hear the application of that law to their life and how it all worked out in practice. Here are the promises to bless obedience, and in Joshua, their obedience is blessed. They do what God tells them, and Jericho's walls fall, even though what God told them to do seemed crazy, irrelevant, and useless. But they did it, and God blessed them. And the land was given to them because they obeyed God. But I'm afraid there are also some examples in these books of the opposite, of where they were disobedient and they were cursed. And unfortunately, though Joshua tells us how they were given the land, the second book of Kings tells us how it was taken away from them again. It's the tragic story now of how the promises to bless them if they were obedient and to curse them if they were disobedient, these books tell us actually how those promises were fulfilled. They were blessed at first, and then they were cursed. And from Joshua through to the end of Kings, it's the sad story of how they got the promised land and how they lost it again. The book of Joshua is mainly a book of obedience, but the seeds of disobedience are there. They got Jericho all right, but they didn't get the next town, Ai, because they were disobedient. So the seeds were already there of losing the land, but it didn't happen for many centuries, and then they lost it totally again. So here the covenant was established between God and the people of Israel, but here it was expressed. It was practically applied to their life. And so we can see the first five books as cause and the next six books as the effect. And you can explain everything that happens in these books in terms of what was said here. So that we are into a different part of the Old Testament. In English, unfortunately, we don't notice that because there are no separate headings. It's just one book after another. But I hope you can see that there is a sharp contrast and we're into something quite different. Now, one of the big questions about all these historical books is, did it actually happen? And I want to mention now a trend in modern scholarship which is very dangerous. And that is to say that the truth in the Bible is not historical or scientific, but truth of moral and religious value. Now let me spell that out. People widely believe that the Bible is full of truth, but what kind of truth? And to say it is a book of moral and religious truth, but not necessarily scientific or historical truth, is a very shaky position. Behind this distinction lies the concept of myth, or legend if you like, or saga. And the idea is that it doesn't matter whether it actually happened or not, but it still has a truth to teach us. Do you follow me? Now, of course, there are parts of the Bible that are like that. Jesus' parables are all technically myth. It doesn't matter whether there was an actual prodigal son or not. The important thing is the story has a truth in it. Do you follow me? And it's very clear that Jesus' parables are like that, that he made up the story to communicate a truth. But when you start saying the whole Bible is like that, then you are into very different territory. Do you follow me? So when you start saying that the stories in the Bible, like the story of Jericho, they have a truth, but don't believe that they actually happened. They are myth containing truth. Not lies, but truth. Now, that development has happened apace. It virtually treats everything in the Bible as parables. Do you follow me? That they are all just legendary stories made up to convey moral and religious truth to us. Something like Aesop's fables. And none of Aesop's fables actually happen, but they all contain a truth. If you've read them, you know. Now, that began in the 19th century to be applied to the book of Genesis. And it began to be said Adam and Eve didn't ever actually live. It is a myth. It is a story to communicate a truth. And the truth is that if you tell somebody not to touch something, they want to go and touch it. And that's the truth in Genesis 3. You follow me? I'm not now advocating this. I'm just trying to explain to you what's been happening. So at first, Adam and Eve were regarded as fable, as parable. As Adam was every man, not a particular man. He was every man. And Eden was everywhere, not a particular place, but contained a truth which could be dug out of it. To get at that truth, you have to demythologize the story. You have to get rid of the story part and just keep the truth part of it. Well, it soon began to apply it to others, to Noah next. And Noah's flood didn't happen. But the story of the flood has a moral or religious truth in it for us. So the Bible became not a book of history, but a book of values. That's the favorite term that's being used nowadays. It's got value, but it's moral and religious, not historical or scientific. Then it began to be applied to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Then Jonah began to be treated as a myth, even though he's presented as a factual man with a genealogy in the book of Kings. And now it has even got right into the New Testament. And in fact, many now church figures question whether the virgin birth actually happened. But it is a story with a truth in it. You see, it's got value for us, but not historical. Then it finally was applied to the resurrection of Jesus himself. And we have bishops saying that it doesn't matter if Jesus' bones lie rotting in the Middle East. That doesn't affect the story of the resurrection. And the story contains the truth that Jesus' influence went on after his death. Now, this is a process that was particularly applied to the book of Joshua and the story of Jericho. And the reason why all this developed was to make the Bible acceptable in a scientific age. Because this enabled the miracles to be dismissed as stories and not actual events. And you can see the motivation behind this. Well, now, what's wrong with that? Because you see, the book of Joshua is full of what a scientific age says are impossible things. The walls of Jericho are not the biggest problem. The biggest problem is the sun and the moon standing still for a whole day. And if it wasn't them that stood still, but the earth that stopped revolving, why wasn't everybody flung off into space when the whole earth stopped with a jerk? And so that is claimed to be a myth. The truth in the story is that God wants to help us win our battles. But the historical truth is not there. Now, I hope I've said enough to show you this development. It is very widespread. So when you turn to the book of Joshua, you're faced with rivers drying up and walls collapsing and sun and moon standing still. What do you make of all that in a scientific age? Well, let's assume that they are fiction for a moment and that they are simply legends. So we cut them out. We demythologize the book. What's left? If you cut the miracles out of the books of the Bible, you are left with a purely human history. And you might as well study the history of ancient Tibet. I'm sure you'd find some value in that. But this is serious. Once you cut out the miraculous part and say that's ridiculous, it couldn't happen, you are actually cutting out God's part in history. And you're only left then with man's part. And what's the point of studying man's history 3,000 years ago? I see no point in it at all. I might as well lecture to you on Chinese culture in the Ding ministry or whatever it is. See, it's as irrelevant as that. Because, in fact, the miraculous is absolutely fundamental to the Bible history. So fundamental that if you cut that out, there really isn't anything left worth studying. Now, let's take this a little further than that. Joshua presents us with real people in real places. Real places, the Jordan River is a real place. You can go and see it. I've baptized people in it. Jericho's a real place. I've stood on the ruins of it. Jerusalem is a real place. You can go and stand in the streets. And the people, the Canaanites, were real people. Archaeology demonstrates that. The Israelites are real people. Their descendants are still with us. Furthermore, the book of Joshua claims to be written by eyewitnesses. It's written in the first person plural. We marched around the walls of Jericho. Now that's a direct claim of people who said we were there. We saw what happened. Why should it be thought that a scholar in the 20th century AD knows better what happened than someone who was actually there? The strange prejudice that comes to such a conclusion. So the book claims to be a record of events written at the time. And one of the frequent little phrases that comes in the book is, and it is there to this day. So people could go and check up on what had been recorded. Now, to dismiss all this as myth is a very arrogant thing to do, unless you have very good evidence. Furthermore, archaeology has been busy confirming a great deal of Joshua. I'll tell you more about the archaeology of Jericho in a moment. But there are other cities that they conquered, cities like Hazor and Lachish, and a number of other cities. And archaeologists have been busy on all these cities, and what they have discovered is that over a period of 50 years, the entire culture of all those cities changed radically to a much simpler lifestyle. They were very sophisticated cities. They were very elaborate, wealthy cities with a culture of their own. Yet over the space of 50 years, all these cities have been utterly destroyed and a new city built on them of a very different culture. That's a remarkable thing for archaeologists to have discovered. And the dating of that change exactly fits with Joshua's account of how they took those cities over a period of 50 years. Now, let's be quite clear that archaeology cannot prove a miracle because it can only examine the results of the miracle and wasn't there to observe what happened at the time. Archaeology can find fallen walls, but it can't find out who knocked them down. For that, we either have to say it was a sheer coincidence and they fell at just the right moment, or we've got to say it wasn't chance at all, and that God was also busy at the time. And to God, knocking a wall down is nothing. Absolutely nothing. Now, there are also parallels to some of the events in Joshua. For example, the Jordan River regularly dries up in time of flood. Now, that sounds a contradiction, but I'll tell you how it happens. It is a very meandering river as it goes down the Jordan Valley. And in flood, when it meanders, it undercuts the banks on the curve. And very often, even to this day, when it undercuts one of the big banks, the bank falls in and temporarily dams the stream until it rises and gets over the dam. And it may stop for 4 or 5 hours. So these things haven't just happened once. They happen again. Furthermore, big buildings do collapse. I don't know how many cathedrals in England have lost their spires and towers this way. They've just suddenly collapsed. Now, I'm not trying to explain the miracles away, but I'm saying these are not isolated events. What is significant about them in the book of Joshua is that they happened at exactly the minute that God said they would happen, and happened just when they were most needed. So you've still got a problem, even if you try and explain it away in naturalistic terms. The heart of the issue is, was God involved or not? And if you remove the supernatural events, you remove the divine activity, and you reduce the Bible to human activity, and it then becomes like any other history book of no more relevance to us today than ancient China. You see, the Bible is not the history of Israel. There is so much excluded. It's not a complete history of Israel. Joshua covers 40 years, yet most of what happened in those 40 years is not recorded. And the fall of Jericho fills about 3 chapters. It's out of all proportion to be a history of Israel. It is actually the history of the God of Israel. The Bible is not the history of what Israel did, but it's the history of what the God of Israel did. And if you cut out what he did, you cut out most of it, because the reason why certain things are given a lot of chapters and other things no chapter is when God was doing something, a lot of attention is given. When God wasn't busy, no attention. That's how the Bible is selected. Because every history is a selection of events according to what the historian thinks is important or significant. And the Bible historians say the only important things in our history are what God did. Because it's not just the history of the God of Israel, it's the history of God and Israel. It's the history of their covenant relationship. And it's the history of how they got on with each other and how they didn't get on with each other. And how God reacted to what they did. And so it's a history of the God and Israel, what he said and did. He's the real hero of the drama. Can I put it as strongly as this? If God had not intervened on their behalf, they would never have got the promised land. It's as simple as that. Because humanly speaking, it was an impossible task for a bunch of ex-slaves who had no military training to go in and take a well-fortified land and replace a culture that was far superior to theirs in humanistic terms. It's impossible. So if you cut the supernatural out, and you cut God out, you've got nothing left of what we call the history of the Bible. It is not the history of Israel. There must have been many, many things they did that are not here. We can put it like this. The covenant at Sinai was like a marriage. The betrothal began with Abraham. That's when God became engaged to this people. At Sinai, he got married. The rest of the years in Sinai were the honeymoon. It was a good deal longer than intended, but the bride wasn't ready to look after a home yet. So the honeymoon lasted far, far longer. But Joshua begins the marriage. They're home from their honeymoon now. They're setting up house together, God and Israel, in the place he wants them to live together, the place he's chosen. Now, how did the marriage work out? That's the real question. And I'm afraid it worked out badly. But since God hates divorce, he never let them go. That's the beauty of it. He refused to divorce them. Had every reason to. So we have this sad story of a marriage that didn't work out, but the faults were all on the wife's side. And God constantly called Israel, "My wife, I'm your husband." And when she went after other gods, he said, "Now you've become an adulteress and even a prostitute." But it's all in marriage terms, all the way through the Old Testament. What happened in Sinai was a wedding service. But a wedding's one thing, and a marriage is another. And working out the marriage after the honeymoon, that's when the real task begins. And it all doesn't begin. Well now, let's look next at the shape of the book. I always find it helpful to see the overall shape of a book, the structure of it, the outline. And once I've got that, I can fit the bits in. Too often, I'm afraid, we read the Bible in bits. Can you imagine reading an Agatha Christie novel 10 sentences at a time, once a week? Can you imagine? I mean, by the time you got to chapter 8, you'd have totally forgotten what happened in chapter 1. And yet we treat the Bible that way, which is the craziest way to read it. The best way to read the Bible is right through a book at a time. That's why I'm making these videos, to get you into the book. Every sentence in a book takes its meaning from the book. That's the context of every text. And a text out of context is a pretext. And if you can understand that, you'll understand everything else I say. Let's look at the outline of Joshua then. It's a sandwich in three parts. Two thin slices of bread and a lot of filling in the middle. There's chapter 1, and then chapters 23 and 24 are the bread in the sandwich. And they are all about this man Joshua. And the prologue, if you like, is his commission from God. And the epilogue is his final sermon and death and burial. So this book covers the life of Joshua from the age of 80 to the age of 120, 40 years. Interestingly enough, that's exactly the same period of Moses' life, covered by Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, from 80 to 120, 40 years. So these two men had the same period of leadership. The difference was that Moses was a lawgiver as well as a leader. Joshua was only a leader. And lawgiving is finished. In the middle, chapters 2 to 22 is a simple account of how they took the land that God had promised them, in spite of the fact that it was already occupied. Chapters 2 to 5 talk about entering the land, how they got over the Jordan and into the promised land for the first time. One lovely little touch is this. The day they got over the Jordan, what is it? Stopped. Manna stopped. And for the first time they had fruit and cornflakes. And they had a proper meal. Interesting. As soon as they got over the Jordan, God stopped feeding them. Now you've got to feed yourselves, he said. But he'd given them a land flowing with milk and honey. So that's entering chapters 2 to 5. Chapters 6 to 12 were how they conquered the land. And the strategy is terrific. You divide to conquer. And so Joshua drove a wedge straight through the middle of the promised land. And having divided the enemy troops into two halves so they couldn't line up against him, he then cleaned up the north and then he cleaned up the south. Brilliant strategy. And God showed him how to do it. But so he conquered the center first, then the south, then the north. I gave it to you wrong way round. And then in chapter 12, we have a list of 24 kings that Joshua defeated. Now, of course, a king wasn't necessarily a king over an empire. The leader of a tribe would be a king, a sheikh, if you like. But there are 24 kings that he... Then came the task of dividing the land up between the tribes who'd conquered it. So we have three simple parts in the middle of Joshua: entering the land, conquering it, and then dividing it up. And that's when they had a national lottery. But more of that later. Literally true. They had a national lottery for it. And I'll tell you why in a moment. Lotteries are biblical. Right up to the day of Pentecost. And then they become wrong. And I'm sure you know why that is. But remember, they chose the replacement for Judas Iscariot by lottery? Well, they did it not because they were appealing to chance. But I'll tell you why they did it later. But they had a national lottery to divide it. Now, have you got the shape of the book, Joshua? A sandwich, his call and commission, which came from both God and the people. That's going to be a very interesting point. Then he led them to enter the land, to conquer it, and divided it properly among the different tribes. And then he preached a final sermon to them, a magnificent sermon. Choose this day who you will serve. As for me and my household, I'll serve the Lord. Tremendous dying. You remember a man's dying words, don't you? And that was his last message. And then he's buried. Well, having got the shape, let's begin to look at it in greater detail. Very simple structure and a very obvious outline. I have to point out that I'm afraid the chapter divisions in our English Bible are so often in the wrong place. I wish I'd been able to do it. But in fact, I honestly believe it should never have been done. I believe very firmly that the Bible should never have had chapter numbers in it and never verse numbers. You would then have to know your Bible. But we've become text people, as if God just gave us a box full of individual verses that we can quote to support anything we wish to prove. And the Bible's become a source of proof texts for people. And you can prove anything you like from the Bible. I can prove atheism from the Bible. There's a verse that says there is no God in the Psalms. Then goes on to say the fool has said in his heart there is no God, but there are the words. There is no God. You can prove anything from the Bible by proving texts. But the context, God gave us a library of books. He didn't give us one book, he gave us a library of books. And each book has its own character. And we must study the book as a whole if we're really going to understand the Bible message. So let's look at his commission first. He was 80, and the call came to him from two directions. I like this. I believe we need this double call if we're going to remain faithful to God. You need a call from God, And you need a call from God's people. And if it's really a call from God, God's people will recognize it and confirm it. Too many people say, God has told me to do this, and it hasn't been confirmed by God's people. Other people have been forced into Christian work because God's people have told them to, and they haven't heard from God about it. But when you've got both, I'm now in a traveling ministry. It's not what I would have chosen, but I live out of a suitcase. But I heard a direct call from God through a prophetic word, but I checked it out with elders, and the elders, after weighing it carefully, said, this is of God. And that's made me secure. I can do it knowing this double confirmation. God and his people. Look for that double call. So Joshua was called by God. It said, God said, Moses is dead. Well, Joshua knew that. But God said, Moses is dead. Now, you. And he said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. That's the promise. Moses got them out of Egypt. You're to get them into Canaan. And those two tasks are very important. He says you will prosper and be successful. He doesn't mean you'll become wealthy. The word prosper has been misunderstood in the Bible. It doesn't mean wealth. But there's a prosperity gospel that has got hold of a lot of people. But prosperous means to achieve what you set out to do. That's a wonderful promise. May the Lord's people prosper. Not may they become wealthy. But may they succeed in what they set out to do for the Lord. And God said there are two things are very important. Number one, your morale. When you go into battle, tactics are important, strategy is important, but the thing that will win the battle is morale. World War II turned on General Montgomery. He became insufferable in victory, as Winston Churchill put it. He was unconquerable in battle, but unsufferable in victory or something. But nevertheless, the Battle of El Alamein, North Africa, that squeaky little voice, we're going to beat this chap Rommel. We're going to win this battle. And a new voice of morale raised the Eighth Army in the desert in World War II. And that was the turning point of the war. And it was largely on morale. And that's why God said to Joshua, your leadership will depend on morale. Be of good courage. You must be courageous. You must say, we're going to win. Your courage will take the battle to victory. Very important point. But the second important point is morality. And he said, Joshua, you must keep my statutes. You must obey my laws. Morale and morality, the two things that God requires of a leader. Interesting, aren't they? Well, Joshua went and told the people, I'm now your leader. Moses is dead. And do you know what the people said? They said, be strong and courageous. And the people actually repeated word for word what God had told him privately. What a lovely confirmation. What a witness. And the people said this. And you may smile at this, but they actually said to him, just as we fully obeyed Moses, we will now obey you. Now, you've laughed at that, but actually you shouldn't. Because they had. This is a new generation, remember. The older generation hadn't obeyed Moses, but these were young men. This was a new, whole new generation. And they had already conquered Moab and Ammon when they obeyed Moses. So they weren't quite so disobedient as you thought when I read that. They genuinely meant it. They said, we obeyed Moses, we're going to obey you now. But be strong and of a good courage. We don't want a leader who gets cowardly or who gets doubts about the crusade. May the Lord be with you as he was with Moses, they said. So now we come to the actual heart of the book. And he led them to enter the land, conquer it and divide it. All related to the land. The land. The land. And that dominates the whole book. Now Jordan was the barrier. It was in flood. And it was 20 feet deep. There are no bridges. And the fords were all well underwater at this time of year. It's the flood time. The rainy time. The first thing he does before entering is to send spies in. But he's not going to send 12. He sends two. Perhaps he remembers that the two spies came back with a good report, but he only sent two, not 12. Now listen, faith is not foolhardy. Jesus emphasized, sit down and count the cost before you go to battle. It's very wise to suss out the situation, to find out what you're facing. Foolhardiness is not faith, and there's a very narrow dividing line between the two. Some people who do things by faith are really being foolish. They haven't thought it all out. They don't know really what they're taking on. And that is not faith. Faith isn't blind. Faith looks at the situation, sends the spies in, now find out what's the situation. And above all, he didn't want to report on the military might. He wanted to report on their morale. What's their morale like now that they've seen us coming? Well, the spies found lodging in a brothel with a prostitute called Rahaf. She became an ancestor of Jesus. The most incredible story. A prostitute. And she took them in and she hid them. And the men of the city heard that spies had come in, and they came looking for them, and she hid them under straw in the roof. And when the men had gone, she sent them west. She said, don't go back to the river, they'll be looking for you. Go further west into the hills, and then in a few days go back. She saved their lives. Why did she do it? She said, because I believe in your God. He's going to give you this land, and I want to be on your side. That's faith. Incredible faith. And one result is that she is held up in the New Testament by two of the writers in the New Testament as a wonderful example of faith. Not a good woman, but a woman of faith. And God can do more with a bad woman who's got faith than a good woman who doesn't have faith. We often forget that. So here was this prostitute, and she hid them and saved their lives. And so they actually, remembering the blood of the Passover lamb, they said, hang something scarlet out of your window, and we won't touch it. We'll pass over your house. Interesting, isn't it? So she hung something that looked like blood out of her window, a scarlet cord. And therefore, her house was the only house that didn't fall down. Well, now, that's what happened before. What happened during the crossing into the sea? Well, the Jordan dried up. But it dried up just as the priest's feet who were carrying the ark touched the water. Yes, it means that further up the river the bank caved in and dammed the stream temporarily. But why did it do it at just that moment? See, there's so many coincidences in the Bible that statistically it can't be. It just cannot be. The odds are much too high. And so the people got across on dry land virtually, whereas the spies would have to swim across earlier. What was really happening? This generation had never seen the crossing of the Red Sea. So God's doing it for them again. Isn't that lovely? They'd heard about the Red Sea, but did they really believe that God could do such things? They were a whole new generation. So now they know the God of their fathers is with them too. That's, I believe, why it happened. A repetition of the Red Sea for the new generation. Well, I think my time for this talk is gone, so we'll stop there, and we've got a lot more to do in the next talk. So come back and we'll continue with the story of Joshua. Well, now here was a picture I was looking for earlier. This is a picture of the Jordan Valley with the Jordan meandering. You can see how it undercuts the banks, and the banks keep caving in and blocking it until the water rises and comes over the top and washes the dam away. Here we have the plain of Moab this side where the Israelites were camped, and over there they can see the hills of Judea, the promised land. Over here are two places, Gilgal, which is an open place, not a town. That's the first place they camped in the promised land. But near it was this terribly fortified town of Jericho, deliberately built there to guard the eastern approach up into the hills, and an impossible barrier. Well, now, after they crossed the Jordan, they stayed at Gilgal for quite some time. They put a cairn of stones. They took 12 stones from the bed of the Jordan and made a little cairn of them at Gilgal as a reminder for future generations of how God dried up the river for them. Remembrance is a very important part of Old Testament piety. You're constantly being told to remember what the Lord had done for you. Of course, Christians are the same. We take bread and wine to do this in remembrance. We need constant reminders of what God has done for us in the past. And their favorite way was to erect cairns of stones, and especially 12 stones, one for each tribe. They also did something else. This whole new generation had not been circumcised. And so all the men of this new generation were now circumcised. It meant they had to stay in camp until their bodies recovered, and they were in pain. They were very vulnerable to attack at that time. Had the Jericho people realized, they could have marched out and really walked over them at that time, but they didn't. And after a few days, they were ready to go. The manna stopped as soon as they crossed the Jordan, because on the other side, it's very fertile. If you go to Jericho today, it's a whole oasis. The best grapefruit and oranges you'll ever taste are in Jericho. I see some of you have been. And so as soon as they got over, they had fruit and vegetables and food again. And they called the place Gilgal, which means rolled away, because God had rolled away the reproach of Egypt. They could forget Egypt now. They were in. Now, a rather strange thing happened. Joshua decided to have a personal reconnoiter of the town, to walk around it by himself, and he went by night. He's walking around this town when he came across an armed man. And he said, whose side are you on? The man said, no. I think that's a lovely answer. Whose side are you on? Are you on their side or ours? No. And then the personage went on to say, the important thing is whose side you are on, Joshua. Are you on God's side? And it was the captain of the Lord's host. I believe that means a senior angel, an archangel. I don't believe it was the Son of God, but I believe it was a senior archangel, captain of the Lord's host. But you're entitled to what you believe. What happened was, Joshua was being reminded that he is not the highest officer in the Lord's army, that he's an under-officer. It's a gentle little reminder. So they set about conquering the land. And as I've told you, they drove a wedge in the center first, and then cleaned up the south, and then cleaned up the north. Brilliant strategy. Now, there's more space given to the first two towns than any others later. That's because the first two towns were terribly significant, one positively and the other negatively. One was a complete victory, and the other was a disaster. Jericho was the victory. Now, Jericho is still there. Even ancient Jericho, though modern Jericho, is a mile down the road. Now, here are some rather poor photographs, but this is looking across the Jordan Valley to the hills of Moab beyond. The Jordan is running there. Here's the oasis of Jericho. And in the middle of it is this heap of rubble. It towers above everything else. It's just a big heap of dust, apparently. It's what we call a tell. Now, the word tell simply means the ruins of a city, or at least of many cities, that have been built on top of each other. As a city was destroyed, so they built another on the top of it. So gradually a man-made hill emerges. You may have noticed in some old villages in England that the front doors of the cottages are way below the street level. That's because the street has been built up and up and up on top of itself. And a tell is formed that way. And so archaeologists, one method is to take one layer off and then the next and then the next, but that destroys each layer as they go down. Another method is to take a slice right out of the middle and see it like a sandwich cake, and then notice the particular pottery in each layer and date it and so on. That's what they've done with this mound. It's just this long mound here. Looking down on it from the air, this is what you would see. Here are all the fruit trees of the Jericho oasis. But here is the old Testament city. Nobody's living in it now. it's just a heap of rubble and ruin, as you can see. But they've actually cut a trench right across the middle there and unearthed the oldest building in the world, which I'll show you in a moment. They have discovered that Jericho is actually the oldest city in the whole world, to our knowledge. It actually dates from 8,000 BC. And in fact, there is one building in it, which I'll show you now, a round tower with a spiral staircase inside it. You can't go down. They've had to put a grid over it because it was people were wearing the stones away. But this round fortification is 8,000 BC. It's 10,000 years old you're looking at. And that is the oldest building in the world. And they found that by digging this trench right through the middle. They've also found a lot of features of the city. And one unusual feature is that it had double walls. Two walls. The outer wall and then a 15-foot gap and then the inner wall. The outer wall was 6 feet thick and made of rock. And the inner wall was 12 feet thick and made of brick. Now, this is the kind of problem that the Israelites faced. That's a mighty big fortification. But something had happened. So let's take those pictures away and look at Jericho. That's a very oversimplified cross-section of the Tell. And you can see how the different ages of cities have been built on top of each other. There's not much of Joshua's city left. Just a little bit here. That's the late Bronze City, the time of Joshua. The main road that you drive along is here. The bus will take you alongside this mound of dirt. And the spring which supplies all the water for Jericho is just alongside it. Lovely fresh water. But if you remember in Elisha's day, that spring became radioactive and had to be cured with a miracle again. But here we have the different cities, the Neolithic city, the pre-pottery age, then the Neolithic pottery age, then the early bronze, the late bronze, just that little bit, Iron Age, and finally bits that are later, but now it's just a rough, dusty thing. And they found various bits of wall here. That's where they found the double wall. Now then, because of that wall, Jericho was very limited in size, but the population grew. So what did they do? They decided to build houses over the two walls, bridging them actually, just to find more space. So it was a very crowded little city, with houses actually sitting on top of the 6 foot wall, then the gap, and then the 12 foot wall. The walls were about 30 feet high. Now bear in mind that it was already on these layers of previous cities. Can you see that the walls, with the extra weight of houses on top of them, are not very strong? Can you see that? Again, I'm not trying to explain the miracle. I'm trying to show you the situation as it was. A slight earth tremor would bring the whole lot down. Whether it was an earth tremor that God used to do that or not, we don't know. It could even have been quite feasible that in fact a loud sustained noise would have done that. And it's very interesting that God told them to blow these horns that I've just blown here, and it says immediately when the horns blew, the walls came down. You know that some singers can bust a light bulb if they get the right note. It may well be that God knew that those walls were already precariously balanced on these slopes and had the extra weight of houses just asking for a collapse. Whatever, I don't know. The fact is that God said, you march round it 7 times, once a day, in total silence, and on the 8th day you blow. And they blew these horns, which I've been trying to blow all night. Or whatever. And you can imagine all those horns blowing on the same note. And the people shouted as loud as they could. And after 6 days' silence, I should think that was pretty unnerving for the inhabitants anyway. But the walls collapsed. And the houses on them. Except for one. Because you remember the prostitute Rahab, her house was on the walls. So God saved one bit of wall. And the scarlet thread out of the window saved her life and her family. And that's how she became the great-great-great-grandmother of King David. And the great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother of Jesus himself. And put in the genealogy in Matthew 1, it's an amazing story. Well, they didn't even have street fighting. They just walked into the city and took it. But God said, this city is the first fruits. It's mine. You don't touch a thing in it. And in that way, God told them, the victory was mine, not yours. You don't deserve anything from this city. This is my victory. You can conquer the other cities, and you can loot the other cities, but you're not to loot this one. And we know that a man did. Because the next place they went to was a place called Ai, further up the hill. That's all that's left of Ai. That's the best photograph I could get of Ai. It's just a heap of ruins. But it was a flourishing city. And they made two errors, two blunders. Number one, overconfidence. And Joshua said, we don't need many troops for this one. It's easy conquering this land. How fatal it is to think that because God has blessed you once, he's going to do it again, or because you've had a success in one sphere, that will be repeated. So often when I've been at an occasion where God has really been present and blessed us, the immediate reaction of people afterwards, we must do this again. And I've said, no, you must not do this again. Because you're thinking, go out and do it as you did before. That's what Samson said. I'll go out as before. You can't repeat God. And they were overconfident and thought that only a few troops would get Ai. More than that, a man called Achan had stolen something from Jericho. He saw some nice clothes and he thought, well, they're no use to God, but I could make use of them. And he saw some gold as well and he took it. Now, when Joshua's troops first attacked Ai, they were routed and they fled. And Joshua came back to God and said, God, why have you let that happen? Now the word will go around the whole country. We are not invincible. We're finished. And he blamed God for it. And God said, Joshua, it could be your fault, you know. Find out who took the forbidden thing in Jericho. And that's when they called the tribes together. Again, they used lottery. And by lot, they settled on this tribe. Then they got the different clans together. And by lot, they settled on this clan. Then they got each family in the clan together. And by lot, they found the family of Achan. Now, why did lots work in the Old Testament? The answer is very simple. They believed that God was in control of every situation. And that when, just for sake of argument, when they tossed a coin, God could catch it and turn it the right number of times to tell them what he wanted. That's the theory. Theologically, it's thoroughly sound. If God can pull walls down of Jericho, he can certainly determine lots. And they used lots deliberately so that man had no influence in this situation. Now, we do that as well. We toss a coin for who goes into bat first at a cricket match. That's to stop any person choosing. But the difference is that when they cast lots, they believe it allowed God to choose because he could control the lot. And that's why they did it right up to the day of Pentecost. After that, God's Spirit guided them. So we don't need to toss coins now. We've got the Spirit to guide us. But in the Old Testament days, that's what they did. The priest carried two stones inside his breastplate, a black and a white stone. And they were called the Urim and the Tummim. And one meant yes and one meant no. And they would go to the priest and say, does God want me to marry this girl or not? And the priest would close his eyes and pull out a stone. If it was a black stone, the answer was no. And if it was a white stone, the answer was yes. I wish we could have guidance that way now. It would be very much simpler and easier just to go to the pastor and say, pick a stone for me. And then you know what to do. Actually, God wants a more personal relationship with us than that. He wants to work it out much more personally. But that was the way they did it. And we shall see that's how they divided the land later. So they cast lots and the lot fell on Achan. As later, the sailors on a ship heading for Spain cast lots and the lot fell on Jonah. You find this again and again, that God controls the lot. He doesn't control the national lottery in our country. But he does control the lot in the Old Testament. And that's important. So, Ai was a disaster, and Achan and his family had to die. They clearly knew what he'd done, and they welcomed it. They were glad to have the clothes and the gold. But one man's sin caused the people of God to fail. It's almost frightening, isn't it, that one member of a church could have the same effect. When there's sin in the camp, you can't sin to yourself. It can affect everybody else and the people of God. Well, finally they reached Mount Ebal, and they obeyed Moses. Moses said, when you get to the mountain in the center, there are two mountains, Ebal and Gerizim. He said, you're to stand on both mountains, some of you, and on one mountain you shout the blessings, and on the other mountain you shout the curses. And if you go to those two hills today, they're just near Shechem, and there's a kind of amphitheater. Both hills are hollow on the face towards each other. So can you imagine a huge two new natural amphitheaters? You can hear perfectly right across the valley. And there they stood and they shouted the blessings and the curses and a reminder of the covenant. Then they went on to the south. I want to go back to the outline. I don't know what I've done with it. Yes, I do. They cleaned up the south, and that's when the sun stood still. They were attacked by five Amorite kings, led by the king of Jerusalem, a man who called himself Lord Righteous. Isn't that interesting? Because Jerusalem was still in enemy hands. And he led five kings to attack them in the valley of Ayalon. Here's a photograph out of a book, as you can see, of the valley of Ayalon with the sun. That's the place where it happened, where the sun stood still. Now, what do we make of that? I'm going to read you something written by Mr. Harold Hill, the president of the Curtiss Engine Company of the United States, a consultant in the American space program. I think one of the most amazing things that God has for us today happened recently to our astronauts and space scientists at Greenbelt, Indiana. They were checking the position of the sun, moon, and planets out in space, where they would be 100 years and 1,000 years from now. We have to know this in order that we don't send up a satellite and it collides with something later on one of its orbits. We have to lay out the orbit in terms of the life of the satellite and where the planets will be so that the whole thing will not go wrong. They ran the computer measurements backwards and forwards over the centuries, and it came to a halt. The computer stopped and put up a red signal, which meant that there was something wrong, either with the information fed into it or with the results as compared with the standards. They called in the service department to check it out, and they said, it's perfect. The head of the operation said, what's wrong? Well, we found there's a day missing in space in elapsed time. They were puzzled, and there seemed no answer. Then one man on the team remembered he'd been told at Sunday school of the sun standing still. They didn't believe him, but as no alternative was forthcoming, they asked him to get a Bible and find it, which he did, in the book of Joshua chapter 10. The spacemen said, there's the missing day. Well, they checked the computers going back into the time it was written and found it was close, but not close enough. The elapsed time that was missing back in Joshua's day was 23 hours and 20 minutes, not a whole day. They read the Bible again, and then it said in Joshua, about a day. These little words in the Bible are important, but they were still in trouble, because if you can't account for 40 minutes, you will be in trouble 100 years from now. 40 minutes had to be found, because it can be multiplied many times over in orbits. Then it was this same man remembered somewhere in the Bible it said that the sun went backwards, and the spacemen told him he was out of his mind, but they got out the Bible and found how Hezekiah on his deathbed was visited by the prophet Isaiah, who told him that he was not going to die. And Hezekiah asked for a sign. And Isaiah said, this sign shalt thou have of the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing that he hath spoken, and the shadow shall go forward 10 degrees or go back 10 degrees. And Hezekiah answered, it is a light thing for the shadow to go down 10 degrees. Nay, but let the shadow return backward 10 degrees. And Isaiah cried unto the Lord, and he brought the shadow 10 degrees backward, by which it had gone down on the sundial of Ahaz. 10 degrees is exactly 40 minutes. So 23 hours and 20 minutes in Joshua plus 40 minutes in 2 Kings make the missing 24 hours, which they had to log in the logbook as being the missing day in the universe. Make of that what you will. That's where it happened. At this point, they began to divide the land, and they did it with a national lottery so that there would be no human influence on the choice. And Joshua sent out surveyors, and they came back with a complete survey of the land. There's a little map here that might just show you. It's a fascinating little land. They're only the size of Wales. It's the only green bit in the Middle East. The Arabian Desert is this side, and the Negev Desert south. The rain comes from the Mediterranean and drops on these hills first, and then on the hills over the Rift Valley. That's all it is. That's the promised land. But it was divided up, surveyed, and they gave by lot the portion to the tribes. 2.5 tribes wanted this part of the land over the other side of the Jordan, in Transjordan, as we call it today. And so Moses had made them promise that they could have that land provided they came and helped their other tribes to conquer this side. And if they helped their brethren to get this land, they could then go back and settle that way. So that's what happened. 2.5 tribes settled here, and the other 9.5 settled on this side, and the land was divided, and everybody was happy with the division. That occupies quite a few chapters in Joshua. There were, of course, special cities. There had to be 6 cities of refuge, 3 either side of the Jordan, where people guilty of manslaughter could flee and not be killed for having murdered. And there were also cities for the Levites. It's all there in the book of Joshua. So we come to the last 2 chapters, the final epilogue, where he preaches this magnificent sermon. There are just 2 things I want to say about this. He's an old man, he's 120, called at the same age as Moses, 80, but now he knows he's going to die. It's amazing how many people in the Bible know when they come to die. And even Christianity, you know, is a way of death as well as a way of life. There's a man in Beaconsfield wrote to all his relatives when the doctor told him he'd reached the end of the road, and he said, come and stay with me, come and see how a Christian dies. What a challenge. So the great men of God, when their time comes, they know they're going, and they usually leave behind a message for which they'll be remembered. The first thing we notice is the office of leadership. Joshua did not appoint a successor. Moses did. Joshua didn't. Why not? Because from now on, one man couldn't handle. The people were scattered. One man would be inaccessible to many of the tribes. From now on, each tribe had to have its own elders. That's a very significant move. It actually failed, and the people wanted one man leadership again and demanded a king. But it was not God's will. God's will was that elders in each tribe should take over the leadership, because that means that people have immediate access to the elders. And that's a very important principle. Once you build a hierarchy with a man at the top, he becomes inaccessible. And it's very important that the will of God for his people was local elders in immediate contact with the local people. But they didn't accept that, and it didn't work. But that was God's will. So he reminded them of the covenant, and he reminded them that God had promised not only to bless, but to curse. And he promised both. And he said, God always keeps his promises. He brought us into this land, but he won't stop dealing with us now. Interesting that Joshua gave all the credit for getting the land to God. Took no credit himself, though he'd led them. He said, God brought us in. God fought for us. God gave us this land. God did it. And you should be jolly grateful to him. So he made them take an oath of loyalty to God. And in chapter 24, a unique thing happens. He speaks in the first person singular as he does in chapter 23. But in chapter 24, I means God. He is now prophesying. And his last message was prophecy from beginning to end. And though he still says I, whereas in chapter 23, I means Joshua, whereas in chapter 24, I means Yahweh, always the God of hosts. And this is what God says through Joshua. He says, I have done all this for you. And there's just one statement of God's that I love. So I gave you a land on which you did not toil, and cities you did not build, and you live in them. And you eat from vineyards and olive groves you did not plant. You didn't, but I gave them to you. I've given you all this. And now, out of gratitude, Joshua speaks again in his own name. So fear the Lord and serve him and be faithful to him and throw away all other gods. That's when he makes that magnificent statement. As for me and my family, we serve the Lord. Now, he said, that's the choice. You've got the land. Whose God is going to be your God now? Now that you've got what you want. Very significant challenge. And they said, we will serve the Lord. So he said, right, I'm going to put that on a stone here. And he set up a stone of witness. Three times they said, we will serve the Lord. The last few verses are three burials. The burial of Joshua. The burial of Joseph's bones. Do you know, all the way for 40 years, they'd carried a coffin out of Egypt. As well as everything else, they actually carried a coffin all that way with Joseph's bones in it, because his dying wish was, bury me in the promised land. And now at last, they bury Joshua, they bury Joseph's bones, and they bury Eleazar, the son of Aaron. So there's a triple funeral that rounds off this book. And it says this, that as long as Joshua and his generation of leaders lived, the people were faithful to God. But when the next generation came, things went badly wrong. One of the biggest problems is passing the faith on to the next generation. It really is. For a second generation of Christians' children to be as enthusiastic as their converted parents who first came to the Lord. It's not easy. And it's a problem that has followed the Christian church for a long time. Each generation has to rediscover God for themselves. And though they may hear what God did for their parents and grandparents, that doesn't make the children go. So let's summarize what we learn from Joshua. As I read Joshua, these are the lessons I learn. I can sum it up in two simple sentences. Without him, they couldn't have done it. But without them, he wouldn't have done it. Now, those are the two very important lessons. There's a balance here. It's so easy to go overboard and put all the responsibility on God or to put it all on us. But there is a biblical balance. Without God, we can't do it. But without us, he won't do it. Notice the change of verb. It's not without us, he can't. It's without us, he won't. And this is the beautiful balance. It goes all the way through the Bible. With God, all things are possible. Without him, he chooses not to work with us. He needs us. He wants us. We are called to be co-workers with God. If Joshua and the people of Israel hadn't cooperated with God, it wouldn't have happened. And yet without him and without his intervention, they couldn't possibly have done it. Now that's the beautiful balance. So first of all, we see a lot of divine intervention in the book of Joshua. We see God's words and we see his deeds. He makes his promises and he keeps them. He made a solemn covenant which he never broke. Not for one minute did God go back on his word. He had sworn by himself, by myself, by God, I'll stay with you. If it means punishing you, I'll punish you. blessing you, I'll bless you, but I'm going to stay with you. It's for better or worse, for richer or for poorer. I'm your God. God cannot tell a lie. I once made a list of things God can't do. Because, you know, when you think of God Almighty, you think he can do anything. No, he can't. There are many things God can't do. And the first thing I wrote down was God can't tell a lie. And I finished up with a list of 31 things that God can't do. And with a shock, I realized that I could do every one of them. Does that make me greater than God? No. Thank God there are some things he cannot do. I'll tell you one thing he can't do. He can't change the past. Once it's happened, even God cannot change it. He can change its effect and its result, but he can't change the event. So God himself can't undo the cross. It's happened. God cannot tell a lie. He cannot break a promise. He just can't. It's against his whole nature. He couldn't promise you something and then not do it. That's God. I think the things he can't do are as wonderful as the things he can do. And he cannot break his word. Now, we've broken our promises, I'm sure. But he can't. It's against his whole character. He cannot make a promise to Israel and then go back on it. Thank God for that. It says, God gave to Israel all the land he promised to their fathers. He did it. And his deeds, he says at the beginning of Joshua, I will fight for you and I will drive them out. I'll do it. That's the meaning of the word Emmanuel. Now I'm going to give you four possible meanings of that word and I want you to vote on it, which you think is right. Meaning number one, God is with us. Meaning number two, God is with us. Meaning number three, God is with us. And meaning number four, God is with us. Now it only means one of those four things. Let's take a quick vote. God is with us. How many? God is with us. God is with us. God is with us. Well, that's pretty evenly divided, but the fourth was right. The fourth was right. Emmanuel means God is on our side. The emphasis is he's going to fight for us, not them. So the emphasis is on us. God is with us. And Emmanuel sums up the God who said to Joshua, I'll fight for you. I'm on your side. If you're on my side. And so we have the division of the Jordan River, the collapse of Jericho's walls, the cessation of the manna, another battle which they won because of an almighty hailstone, the lengthening of the day in the valley of Ayalon. Another time God sent hornets. And even while the enemy were marching towards them, these hornets came. Now, if you can imagine a swarm of hornets, I tell you, you don't stay and fight. You run. And that's how they won one of the biggest battles, just through hornets. See, God controls the insect world again. And all this was his doing, and it was marvelous in their eyes. But the other side is equally important. God does it through human cooperation. He didn't fight by himself. They had to be in the battlefield. They had to go. And God fought for them. Now, this is the balance. Some people just say, oh, well, leave it to God. He'll do it all. Other people talk as if they can do it all. And you find both sorts of Christians. But the balanced Christians pray as if it all depends on God and work as if it all depends on them. There's a kind of beautiful balance in the Bible here. Without them, he wouldn't have done it. They had to go in and he said, every bit of land you stand on, I'll give it to you. But you've got to go and stand on it. So without them, he wouldn't have done it. Their attitude, if their attitude remained one of confidence and their action one of obedience, they would win every battle. But if their attitude became self-confidence and their action became disobedience, they'd lose every battle. And that's why, though the book of Joshua covers 40 years, the two major parts of it are the story of Jericho and the story of Ai. If you learn the lessons of those two towns, then you're set for the conquest of the land. Interesting, isn't it? Well, the Bible, as I've said earlier, is a very honest book. And it says they did make three mistakes, only three, when they took the land. The first was at Ai. They were defeated by superior troops because they had too much self-confidence. The second I haven't mentioned was where one of the tribes already in the land tricked them. And they tore their coats and they put on old shoes and they blackened their faces and they came to the Israelites and they said, "We've come from a distant land because we've heard God is with you. Look at our clothes, look at our shoes. We've walked hundreds of miles because we hear about your God." They'd only come from round the corner. And because they put on this show, it says Joshua didn't ask the Lord about them. And he was fooled. And he made a peace treaty with them. A devastating thing to do. And only then discovered that they were just living around the corner. And this was their way of escaping defeat. And they didn't ask God about it, so they were tricked. And the third time was when the 2.5 tribes that were going to live on the far side of the Jordan finally went off to claim their territory. And when they crossed the Jordan, they put up a cairn of stones. And the tribes on this side of the Jordan said, "Hey, they've built an altar, so they're not going to be part of us." And misunderstanding arose among God's people. And they said to them, "We're going to fight you." And they gathered an army to go and defeat the 2.5 tribes. Internal misunderstanding. And the 2.5 tribes said, no, we've done that to remind our children and our children's children that we came from your side of the Jordan and that we belong with you. And the misunderstanding was removed and peace came back. So even among the people of God, there can be misunderstanding when you don't ask God about things. Well, what's the Christian application of Joshua? Very simple. In the New Testament, Joshua is used as an example of faith. Rahab the prostitute is an example of faith again and again. Achan is used as an example of sin in the people of God. And their corresponding event in the New Testament is Ananias and Sapphira, which exactly corresponds to the sin of Achan in the old people of God. Do you remember the couple? And then, of course, it's used for salvation because, in fact, Joshua's name means salvation. It was originally Hoshea, but Moses changed it to Yahshua, which is the same as Jesus and means God saves. When my wife and I moved to the village where we live, the postmaster was called Mr. God Save. And it was delightful going to visit Mr. God Save the postman. But actually, in Hebrew, he would be Mr. Yahshua. Or Mr. Jesus, Mr. God Save. And finally, what is the promised land for the Christian that we're to be brought into? Not heaven. When you sang, "When I Tread the Verge of Jordan," I wonder what you were thinking about. Were you thinking about death? Because the promised land for us is not heaven. The promised land is holiness. Because the promised land is rest from battle. It's the promised land of victory when you've won the battle. And you can enjoy what God has for you. And of course, whenever you overcome a temptation, you have a little foretaste of the rest, don't you? You've won the battle. And there's a rest from the conflict. There remains a Sabbath rest, says Hebrews 4, for the people of God. Joshua didn't get people into that rest. And there remains a Sabbath rest for us to get into. And it's to cease from our own works. It's to take a holiday from yourself and rest. Actually, most holidays we take ourselves away with us. And that's not rest, is it? But to take a holiday from yourself and cease from your own works is to enter into the promised land of God's rest and enjoy his victorious life. The best book on Joshua I've ever read is Alan Redpath's little book, Victorious Christian Living. Do get that book. It's how the book of Joshua enables Christians to enter into their promised land of rest from battle. Amen.